Ready for all the craziness of small business. It's exactly that craziness that makes it exciting and totally unbelievable. Small Business Radio is now on the air with your host, Barry Moltz.
Well, thanks for joining this week's radio show. Remember, this is the final word in small business. For those keeping track, this is incredibly show number 504. This episode is provided by Nextiva, the all-in-one communication platform. It's also provided by Square Payroll, the easy way to pay your team. Go to www.square.com/go/SBR. It's also provided by LinkedIn, the place to advertise to generate leads and build relationships with your audience. If you want to get a free $100 ad credit, go to www.linkedin.com/SBR. Well, I've always been amazed at people that can work with their spouse or another family member. When I first started my own businesses, I thought it'd be a great idea to work with my wife, Sarah. And I have to tell you, that lasted for one day. But millions of people make it work. Our next guest will tell us how to do it. Jason Pfeiffer and Jennifer Miller are married and are authors of a new novel that just came out this week called Mr. Nice. Jason's the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine and the host of two podcasts, Problem Solvers, about entrepreneurs solving unexpected problems in their business, and Pessimist Archive, a history of unfounded fears of innovation. He's been the editor, an editor at Fast Company, Men's Health, Maxim, and Boston Magazine. Jennifer is the author of three prior books, most recently her novel, The Heart You Carry, as well as a journalist. She's a regular contributor to New York Times, The Washington Post, Bloomberg Business Week. Jason and Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us. Really appreciate
it. Yeah, thanks for having us.
So Jennifer, go first. Why write this book together with Jason?
So when I finished my previous novel, you know, I was looking for a new project, and Jason had come up with this idea for Mr. Nice Guy long before we met. The premise, very shortly, is two people who sleep together each week and then critically review each other's sexual performance in a magazine.
Wow.
And he knew, yeah, it's not really 50 Shades of Grey. It's definitely a little titillating, but we, you know, so we knew that we wanted the magazine column to be in the book. And I knew that I could write a really good narrative. I could craft great characters. But I knew that writing the columns wouldn't really be my strong suit. But Jason could totally do it because, you know, he's been in local newspapers. He's written a lot of columns. And so I thought, you know, it would just be a natural thing for us to divide up the work for Mr. Nice Guy. I'd write the narrative. He'd write the column.
So, Jason, have you guys collaborated before on other projects?
Yeah, we have. We've collaborated quite a lot going all the way back to our time dating where Jen had asked me to edit one of her early books. And, you know, I think that it's really important, you know, what Jen just said there about how we knew at the very beginning how our partnership would work and the things that we would bring to it is really important because, you know, this is not, we didn't just pair up just because it was we were the nearest writers to each other, right? It's not like you just pair up just because. You do it because you have complementary skill sets. You have something that you know the other person can bring to a partnership that you don't have. That is why I think Your Nice Guy was a success and why our partnership was a success. And we knew that because, yeah, we had done little versions of it along the way, even just things as simple as, hey, can you take a look at this? You know, oh, I just wrote this. Can you read it and tell me what you think? That'll tell you a lot about how you work with someone, if that person is defensive, if that person is uncomfortable taking your feedback. And so we had known before we got into a big project that we were good on the little project.
So, Jason, that really means that, and I think this goes for being partners on anything. I mean, I've had good business partners and I've had bad business partners, that you got to really decide on what role you're going to play inside the partnership, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, so I commissioned at Entrepreneur a survey of 1,000 people, and we asked them how many of them have worked with close friends, family members, or spouses, and then if they did it, how did it go? Amazingly, 87% of people said that they had worked with a close friend, family member, or spouse. 78% actually said that it was a good experience, and the number one reason why they said it worked, the number one strategy that they had to make it work was distinct roles and responsibilities, that each person knows what they are responsible for and what the other person is responsible for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good place to start. And Jennifer, I've always felt in my partnerships, when I had my last two businesses, I had actual business partners, I thought that communication was really key. I always treated it like another marriage, but this time really without the sex.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's really interesting that in this partnership that Jason and I embarked on, this kind of professional and creative partnership, that we were actually writing a book about what happens when two people are forced to communicate about last night's sex, which is the thing that nobody ever communicates well about. And you know, it was actually a really interesting experience for us. As we were writing this novel, it really forced us to open the lines of communication in our own relationship, in our own marriage. So in a way, like what was happening in the book, in some way was actually happening in real life, that we had to figure out how to, especially, you know, sometimes you disagree. Sometimes, you know, you have a creative vision that isn't the same as your partner's creative vision. And that's okay. It's really all about how you approach the conversation and really having it. Because I think a lot of times, and this is, you know, something that happened to the characters in our book, that, you know, that one of our protagonists, he has been in this long-term relationship when the book opens and has just not, he has not voiced any of the frustrations that he had about the relationship because he was embarrassed, because he didn't want to rock the boat. And of course, you know, when you have that pent-up, when you have that pent-up frustration, a relationship or a creative project cannot. And so we put that directly in the book. We also had to work through it as professional partners and as a married couple.
So what you're saying is that you actually got to some point where you were critiquing each other's sex life as it was happening, or it was the next day, I guess.
Yeah, I mean...
But it didn't get published anywhere, right?
No. Readers will have to read into what happens between the characters and determine if any of that has actually happened between me and Jason. We're not going to say too much about it.
So Jason, what is really the key, really, for effective communication? Because people throw those words around all the time, but it actually is hard to do. What really works with you and Jen, and also with your experience with small business owners, what's really worked with partners?
It's a great question. And it actually, interestingly, goes to the number two strategy for making it work from that survey, which was allowing for constructive criticism. I think that what you need to do is make sure that, like, the key word there is constructive, right? That you, if you can build the relationship, the trust between two people to understand that both of you, when you bring something that some kind of criticism, some sort of point of difference to the conversation, that it is done in the service of being constructive and useful, and that it's never personal, it's never harsh, and it is always done with the other person's feelings and perspective in mind, right? So when I had a disagreement with Jen over something to put in the book or something about the marketing of the book or whatever, I always tried to keep in mind what she was going for, like, you know, what was the, even if I didn't agree with maybe the decision she made about what to put in the book, but we what could we agree on? We could agree on that we were both going for the same thing, that the ultimate objective was the same, and maybe we just had a different idea of the way to get to that objective. If you can keep in mind that you were both doing the same thing, you were both trying to get to the same place, and that the other person is never trying to stop you from doing that, it's just about how to do it better, then I think you can march forward together and find the best way.
You know, Jennifer, Jason mentions a word called trust, which obviously is very important in any kind of relationship and communication. For a lot of people, trust is given very easily. For other people, it takes a long time to build it up. For some people, trust is broken very easily. For other people, it takes a long time to break that trust. What are really the keys, if you're working together, to build that trust and really keep it?
I mean, I think that it really goes back to what we were saying before about open communication. It's really interesting, you know, just thinking about my relationship with Jason. I remember early on, right after we got married, you know, Jason was actually feeling kind of, you know, he had this idea that when you get married, you have to do everything with your spouse. I don't know where he came up with that, but that was kind of the idea.
My wife told me that a long time ago, Jennifer, that's not going to happen. You better find some friends.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Like, I didn't have that. I didn't feel that way. But Jason was kind of under that impression. He wasn't saying it. And I could just tell that something was bothering him. And so finally, I confronted him about it. And I asked him, like, you're frustrated about something. Can you talk to me? What is the thing that you're frustrated about? And, you know, he hadn't even thought to voice it. But then we were able to have that conversation. And then, in fact, the result was, no, Jason, you need to go out with your dudes and, like, do your dude thing. Like, I don't want to spend every second with you. And it was really, you know, it was really that kind of communication that, you know, that made me understand, like, you know, he has these ideas, like, here's where he's coming from. And I trust him to go out and, like, have his dude night. Like, I'm going to be home, like, with my girls, like, doing the thing that I want to do. And so I think, you know, being able to actually talk about that stuff as opposed to keeping it bottled up inside, like that's when you start doubting the other person. That's when you start questioning the other person's motives. As long as you've got it out there in the open, then you can really build that trust.
Well, Jason, I'll give you a piece of advice. I took up long-distance cycling. It takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I think I just took on more work, which also takes a lot of time.
You know, one of the things, Jason, I want to talk to you about is I love that your marketing strategy really heavily relies on relationship building, because I really am a firm believer that people don't want to buy our stuff anymore, right? They want to have relationships with the customer. They want to have relationships with the people instead of transactions. Why talk about that a little bit and why relationships are so much more valuable than the actual transaction.
Oh, yeah. It's really been the foundation of the way that we thought about marketing this book. It's all about relationships, not transactions. For me, that starts by being on the other side of most people's outreach, which is to say, you know, as the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, I am getting people reaching out to me all the time who want something. And so many of them are transactional. Most of them are transactional, which is to say somebody reaches out. I don't know them. I have no investment in them. And they want something from me. And I am not all that incentivized to be interested in what it is that they want. But then there are these other people who really very smartly just start building a relationship with me. Small ways, right? Even just like following me on Instagram and then sending me some comments saying, oh, I like this, I like that. They never ask for anything. And then maybe 2 years down the road, they ask for something, whether it's, you know, some piece of advice or me to show up at an event or whatever. And at that point, I am invested in them and I'm so much more likely to help them. And I just started thinking a lot about that as we were going into the marketing of this, that if we reach out to people out of nowhere and just ask to have the thing that they have, that everybody else is asking, we're not special in any way. We're not special to them. And we need to be special because you want people to be behind you. You know, you don't just go out and ask for something the second that you want it. What you do is you build a community and then rely upon that community. Those are the people who will champion you. And so the fortunate thing that we had here with this book, and this is true for anybody in any business, is that we had quite a lot of ramp-up time. You know, like when you know something is going to happen, start building that network long before you even need those people, because it is so much easier to reach out to people when you really genuinely don't have anything that you could ask them to do for you, because it is very tempting to just ask and ask and ask for stuff. But if you reach out at the point where, I mean, we were reaching out to people long before we had a book to send them. And that means that when a year goes by and now we do have a book to send them, they are so much more interested in it.
I couldn't agree more, Jason. This is such an important point because a lot of folks only reach out when they want something. I mean, I will go a year or two and I won't hear from people except, oh, I came out with a new book. I'd like to be on the show, right? And then there's not that really that much incentive because, again, it's all about building that community and that relationship. So, Jen, one of the last things I wanted to talk about was this idea of having a creative outlet if you're going to have a successful partnership. And I know we talked about that a little bit. Why is that so important if people are going to work together?
I think that you want to be able, you want the space to express yourself. You know, you don't want it to be all business. And I think, you know, I think when you're working on a creative product and you want it to do well, there's obviously, like, there's an entrepreneurial mindset that you've got to have in order to sell it. I mean, Jason and I are certainly, you know, we're not precious about our work. We don't think of what we're doing as art or high art, you know. We think of it as something that we want people to buy, we want people to read. But the ability to actually, like, use your imagination and to think in innovative ways and to be able to create, like, it's a really freeing thing to be able to do that in your professional life. And I think that when you're with a partner and you're able to do that together, there's just something that's so fulfilling about that. And that really lets you get to know your partner in a way that you know, might not if everything you're doing is just numbers and stats and pure business.
Yeah, I can't agree with more. It's like doing some kind of mission together. Actually, I lied, Jason. I have one more question to you. We talked about when things go right. What happens when things go wrong? Because sometimes that really tears at the fabric of a relationship.
Yeah, of course it does. And things are going to go wrong. I mean, I think that the foundation of dealing with something going wrong is to know that something's going to go wrong when things are going right, right? You have to put yourself into the mindset of this is a long journey and there are going to be ups and downs and we're going to need to get through them all, right? I think that often what happens is that when something goes wrong, people, they start almost acting like it's never going to go right again. Or so they shift into this mindset of we're dealing with end times. And I think that you just have to focus on the ultimate goal and keep in mind that this is a long journey. Everything that you're going to get involved in entrepreneurship or in, you know, the creative field, whatever, it is a long journey. There are going to be lots of ups and downs. And always remember that all the things around you that you are seeing that you're maybe modeling yourself on, you know, like in the case of maybe our book, looking at other books that, you know, have been really successful or other writers, keep in mind that like the success that you see was only the end point of their story. I was recently emailing with Kevin Kwan, the author of Crazy Rich Asians, who has endorsed our book in an amazing and wonderful way. But he was telling me that, you know, everybody thinks that he just woke up one day and wrote an international bestseller. And that's not the case. It took him 15 years of learning and trying and building relationships to ultimately know how to create the thing that he did. All you see is the end story, but there was so much more. And you have to understand that you are on the same journey that everyone else is on.
I love that, Jason, because I always say that overnight success takes 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
I appreciate you both being on the show. Jen, where can people get a copy of this book and get in touch with you if they've got more questions or want to have a relationship with both of you?
Sure. So you can get Mr. Nice Guy on Amazon or at your local bookstore. You can find it also online at MrNiceGuyNovel.com. And you can also go there to get our social feeds and all that good stuff.
Oh, and I should also say that there's an audiobook as well. So wherever you get audiobooks.
And are you both narrating it?
We're narrating the columns. So we have it. There was an actor hired to do the book part of it, but you know the characters' columns are in there, and we went into the studio and recorded those columns, which was fun and awkward because they're intense columns.
So this is
that's
one book.
That's where all the sexy stuff is.
Yeah.
So we're reading it. It was a trip.
Now that I know this is one book, I'm not going to read. I got to listen to it. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
This is AMA 20 WCPT Chicago. We'll be right back. I know a lot of small business owners are confused about where to advertise online and how to actually get results. You gotta be diligent because you can lose a lot of money fast if you don't choose the right platform and the right audience. The question I always get is, should I advertise on a search engine like Google or a social media platform like LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter? For small business owners, LinkedIn is the place to drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term, purposeful relationships that result in boosting their business. This is because effective search engine advertising should target audiences, not keywords. LinkedIn's network has more than 575 members, and their advertising gives you the ability to effectively target the right message to the right people while they're working. It has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to their job title, company name, and industry. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers who are on LinkedIn are decision makers at their company, so you're building relationships with the people that really matter. This will result in higher quality leads and more website traffic. So to redeem a $100 free LinkedIn ad credit and launch your first campaign, please use this website for listeners of Small Business Radio Show. You got to go to LinkedIn.com/SBR. That's LinkedIn.com/SBR for your free $100 ad credit. Remember that terms and conditions apply. Let me know about your results.
You've already upgraded your cell phone to a smart device, which lets you use the internet to be more productive on the go. But what about your desk phone? Nextiva.
Nextiva
is a smart business phone system in the cloud. With a simple setup through an internet connection, you can soon have access to your office communications wherever you are. Stay seamlessly connected with clients and stay more mobile than ever before with just one low monthly cost. Give your business more than just a basic desk phone. Visit Nextiva.com or call 800-799-0600 to learn more today. Nextiva.
Nextiva.
Simplifying your business communications. Get a copy of Barry's book, BAM, where he shows how social media and our self-service world have rewritten all of the rules of customer service. The best marketing now is BAM. Good customer service. Be the first to tweet Barry at Barry Moltz and get a free copy of the book, BAM.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Moltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Well, if you've been paying attention to current events, it is a new world for women. But my next guest says that it is also a new revolution for women entrepreneurs. Natalie Molina Nino is the CEO and founder of Brava Investments, investing in high-growth, innovative businesses that deliver measurable economic benefit for women. A technologist and coder by training, Natalie launched her first tech startup at the age of 20. She's also the co-founder of Entrepreneurs at Athena at the Athena Center for Leadership Studies of Barnard College at Columbia University. She has served as a business and global growth advisor to industry leaders in the for and nonprofit sectors, including Disney, Microsoft, MTV, Mattel, and the Bill and Linda Gates Foundation. She's got a new book out. It's called Leapfrog, The New Revolution from Women Entrepreneurs. Natalie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be on.
So we always talk about how women are not getting as much venture capital as men, that it's more difficult for women in business. Why do you think there's a new revolution for women entrepreneurs?
You know, we do talk about that a lot. And I would say not women not getting as much of the VC capital is an understatement, right? When we get 2.5% of it, that is egregious, right? But what a lot of people don't talk about is that actually it's 0.2% if you're a woman of color, right? Which is to say, it feels like a complete lockout. And so what's interesting about that, and maybe a more positive spin, is that while we know that women are starting more companies than men, and that's what makes those numbers particularly salty, what we also know is that 8 out of every 10 of those women-led businesses is started by a woman of color. And so, you know, the reality is that women of color, women generally, but especially women of color, are leading when it comes to being entrepreneurial, when it comes to taking that leap and becoming a startup founder. And what we need is we just need to give them the tools to get beyond this $1 million revenue mark, which 98% of women-owned businesses don't cross that threshold. So we're there. We're on the precipice. We just need a set of tools, and we need people to basically get out of our way so that we can scale our companies and take over the economy.
So what needs to happen in your mind, Natalie?
You know, there are strategies that are long view strategies. There are strategies that are going to take years to put into place. And I'm all behind those sorts of strategies. Like, for example, the fact that we need more women in venture capital. We need more women to get loans. We need more. We need sort of system shift. But we also need to just be pragmatic and think about what we have to work with today. Right. And for example, women are disproportionately more successful at crowdfunding. So let's double down on that. And that's a big part of what I write about in my book. Women are also not taking advantage of programs that are out there right now, partly because they're not well marketed, right? The SBA a few years ago when I first met with them had $4 billion with a B, allocated in the form of low interest loans, in the form of grants, in the form of equity investing that was actually in pretty good terms, that was really allocated for a series of small businesses that fell into various different categories, be they veterans, be they people with disabilities, be they women, be they people of color. And when I met with them, $4 billion had been set aside, $2 billion had actually been allocated, and there was $2 billion worth of this sort of funding that was just sitting there going unused because people were not aware of the programs. So I think that there's a lot that we can work with right here, right now, because I don't have a lot of hope that suddenly tomorrow the VC world that exists today is going to wake up and, you know, suddenly go from 2.5% to 50, which is probably where they should be, if not more, given that more women are starting businesses than men.
So do you think that the idea is that we've got to go to the government for perhaps low interest loans or this idea of crowdfunding? That's really where the majority of expansion capital is going to come from for women, at least in the immediate future.
I mean, I think what we have is we've got to look at alternative sources, right? We look at the places where women are shut out, and then we look at sort of progressive changes, that will happen over time in that sector. But in the meantime, for the entrepreneurs that are right here, right now, we look at all the places that we're not looking and where there are resources available. I do think crowdfunding is one. I do think there are programs, not just government, but private sectors. There are foundations that are out there giving grants, that do competitions, that do lines of credits, bridge loans, things that are really helpful for businesses when they're in growth mode. But, you know, I use examples of women and men in the book that have actually circumvented the whole outside capital strategy altogether. Nina Vaca is a woman who owns the fastest growing woman-owned company in the United States. This year, it'll hit $1 billion in revenue. And this myth that VCs will often tell us, which is that the only way to grow your company and grow it fast is to take venture capital. Well, she's at $1 billion. She's the fastest growing woman-owned company. And guess what? She never took a penny of outside investment. So I also think that there's something to be said for staying scrappy, using some of these different vehicles that are still capital but not equity, which means that you're not giving away a percentage of your company and not giving someone else the right to fire you someday.
We're talking with Natalie Molina Nino. She's the author of Leapfrog, The New Revolution for Women Entrepreneurs. I want to go back just again, that idea that only 2.5% of venture capital go to women. And I think you said 0.2% go to women of color. Why is that? What I've heard before is that all the venture capitalists are basically white men and they're giving money to people that are like them. Is that what you've seen in your experience?
I will say yes. And it's my experience. It's also just the data, right? I mean, the percentage of VCs that are women and the percentage of, you know, VC money that goes to women. I mean, it's hard to come to a different conclusion than that. They're clearly doing pattern matching and only investing in people who look like them. But I would add to that, the same thing is true even among women who invest in women. The reason that we have 0.2% of all venture capital going to women of color is because we have, for example, by last count, over 58 funds that focus on women. Wharton did a study that's called Project Sage that catalogs all of the different funds and platforms that focus on investing in women. And guess what? White women are investing only in other white women. So I think there's a human tendency to invest in what you know, to invest in what looks like you. I would love to think about strategies for how we get people to expand their horizons and think differently and actually invest where the opportunities are rich, where there are amazing companies that are going to make great returns. But again, you know, we've tried. I wouldn't advocate for stopping our efforts, but I would advocate for getting more women, women of color, people of color into these investment spaces, because I think that until the investors are more diverse, we're not going to see a real significant moving of the dial.
So, Natalie, what role do you think the whole Me Too movement really has with this whole thing with women getting funded? Because certainly it's in the top of all of our minds right now.
You know, I think I've been asked a lot about this, and I'm very involved with Time's Up, which is an organization that is, of course, connected to this movement very deeply. You know, at the end of the day, I think that not a lot has changed. I think what's different is that now women have found the power in alliances, the noise that you can make when you're not just one voice in the dark saying, you know, I have experienced this, but you're actually buddying up with your friends who have also experienced something similar. What happened two summers ago in the VC space, right, with a number of young women entrepreneurs getting together and naming names and actually holding people accountable for their behavior. You know, 20 years ago when I was just starting in this space, let's be honest, the same stuff was happening, but we were not as savvy. I'm not going to speak for all women of my generation, but I believe that we were not savvy. We didn't build alliances. I think if we had, we might have been able to nip this problem earlier. But I'm proud. I'm so proud of this next generation of women who are basically saying, we're going to build alliances. We're going to benefit, you know, from the power of numbers, and we're going to make noise, and we're going to call out behavior that has never been okay. Nothing has changed, right? It wasn't okay 20 years ago. It's not okay now. This confusion that I'm hearing with people saying, well, men are confused about how to behave in the workplace now. Well, you know, sweetheart, nothing has changed. It wasn't okay 20 years ago. It's not okay now. The only difference now is that we're not going to stand for it.
You know, it's interesting. My wife Sarah and I, we went out with a couple and we were talking about the whole, you know, Brett Kavanaugh thing about pushing this woman down, putting his hand over her mouth. And one of the gentlemen we went out with, and he's much older, he said, yeah, you know, I used to do that when I was, you know, in college. It was just my hormones raging and it's all okay. And I'm like, what? Right?
Yeah.
It wasn't okay then. It really wasn't okay now. So I think we still got some work to do. You talk about building alliances. Who are these alliances with in order to get support in this area?
You know, they're so far reaching. And this is what's, I think, exciting about this is when, for example, the list of women actors, right, who came out and of course, named Harvey Weinstein, but so many others. When that happened, I don't know if you remember, but shortly after that, there was a woman named Monica Ramirez, who is responsible for an organization that advocates for the rights of women in agriculture, of farm workers who are exposed to levels of sexual harassment and abuse that are beyond what most of us can even imagine. And she responded to that letter and said, we're behind you. And it was a beautiful, beautiful letter that went viral. And then you see an unlikely alliance of actresses and celebrities with, you know, thousands and thousands of farm workers. And then you have an alliance, of course, with women in the press, women in the media. You've got All Rising, which is an organization of women VCs that are working on exactly these issues to try to get more women in the partner level at venture capital firms. So think about that. It's actresses, it's farm workers, it's press, it's venture capitalists. It's a whole series of unlikely alliances that together make for a really powerful groundswell that's just kind of putting everyone on notice and telling the world that, you know, as you said, the behavior has never been acceptable, but unfortunately it's been tacitly accepted. That day and that era is over.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I wrote a piece on my blog when this first started coming out about how this has been going on in small business all the time, how men talk about things differently when women are in the room and when they're not in the room, and that really just shouldn't happen. So, and I want to switch gears about more about this women revolution in entrepreneurship. You talk about in the book that you have to be a big fish in a small pond. You know, a lot of people think that the only things that are really going on in the world of technology is in San Francisco or Austin or New York. And that's just not true.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would argue that there might have been more truth to that a few years ago, but the reality is that is not the case anymore. I belong to a group that I feature in the book called Breakout, which is a group of founders from all over the country. And we go and we spend a 3-day weekend in different cities around the country. And we've done it in New Orleans, in Detroit. We just did Chicago. We've done Baltimore. We did Atlanta last summer. And the amount of activity, exciting activity happening in all these cities, there's another person profiled in the book, Arlen Hamilton, right, who's behind Backstage Capital. She has just announced that she's starting an incubator in like 4 different cities. The 4th city was up to a vote of anybody who wanted to participate. And the vote just came out yesterday, and they're going to start it in Detroit. So there are exciting things happening in all of these cities that have been previously considered not, to your point, you know, the epicenter of startup activity. And I wouldn't say that they are at the level of activity that you would see in New York or Silicon Valley, but there's some really, really good things happening. And I do think that there's a benefit of being a big fish in one of these smaller ponds, because you have easier access to other founders. You have easier access to some of the political people who might be helpful. You have easier access even to some of the local foundations that can do program-related investments. A lot of people don't realize that even a nonprofit foundation can make capital investments into a for-profit. These are all things that are more accessible when you know everyone in your small city, right?
Another thing you talk about in the book, Natalie, is this idea of trying to use influencer marketing. And you say that you have to out-Kardashian the Kardashians. What does that mean?
Well, here's the thing. Imagine a scenario, right? Where, and I see this a lot. This is a common mistake where somebody says, look, I've got a consumer product of some kind, and I'm going to have, you know, somebody who has 5 million followers on YouTube hold my lipstick or hold my, you know, whatever, new, you know, drink product in their next video because they have 5 million followers. But the reality is, let's say it's a swimsuit model, right? And you're advertising some product that a lot of women will want to buy for their next summer vacation. Well, that swimsuit model, if you actually look under the hood and you see who are those 5 million people who are following her, chances are, and I have an actual case study that shows, 80% of one example that we looked at had just been looking at porn 5 minutes ago. So, you know, this is not your target audience. This is not the sort of people that are going to be buying some product that's really designed for women who travel, right? So I think we need to get smarter about not just going for the numbers at brute force, but actually finding and doing things like influencer marketing in a more thoughtful way where you're actually connecting with people who maybe don't have 5 million followers. They may only have 30,000 followers, but that 30,000 followers are really gung-ho on your product, on your category, on the topic that you play in and the business that you're in. And I think that's what I mean. Let's not do dumb influencer marketing. Let's get, you know, a little more thoughtful and focus, really targeted on who our market is and talk to them only.
Natalie, the last question I want to ask you, there's a lot of women that listen to this radio show. What's the one piece of advice you'd give them? Where should they start if, you know, they get up every day and some days they just feel lost about growing their business?
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably one of the biggest problems for any founder, right? You kind of end up in a silo, you end up in a little bit of an echo chamber. I would say the best way to get out of that funk is to, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, figure out where are the meetup groups, where are the affinity groups that play in your space, where can you find a group of people who become almost like your personal board of directors, and then commit to actually meeting with them. In the book, I talk about a mastermind group that I created at Barnard, where we got 8 women to commit for 9 months to meet for dinner once a month. If every woman had a group like that around them, a group of diverse women who are all having unique entrepreneurial experiences to basically, you know, gather around you and be that support system. And I would argue women or men, that are going to be helpful in your business, that is exactly the sort of thing that will get you on your way out of what can be a pretty lonely little silo that founders often find themselves in.
Well, the title of the book is Leapfrog, The New Revolution for Women Entrepreneurs. Natalie, where can people get a copy of the book or get in touch with you?
You know what? They can find it just about anywhere, including Amazon or their local bookstores. But if they want to know more about the book, they can go to leapfroghacks.com.
Natalie, thanks for being on the show. This is AM 820 WCPT Chicago. We'll be right back. Whenever I talk to a small business owner, I insist on one function they should always outsource, and that's payroll. You see, payroll is complicated, and both the employee and the government insist that you get it right. You see, when you do payroll, not only do you have to deduct money from the employee's paychecks to remit to the government, but as an employer, you need to add to it. Plus, you need to send this money to various government agencies on a regular basis, and if you don't do it, they will hold you personally liable for it. So this is one thing you gotta stop worrying about. That's why I recommend the new Square Payroll app. With this app, you can do everything from setting up an account to paying your team. It's fully integrated with Square Payments and time cards for W-2 employees and contractors. Square takes care of your tax withholdings, payments, and filings at no extra cost. There is flexible and transparent pricing that scales with your business. So go ahead, search Square Payroll in the Apple iTunes or Google Play app stores to download this app, or visit www.square.com/go/SBR to learn more.
Thinking of starting your own business? Get on board for a crazy ride. Be the first to tweet Barry at Barry Moltz and get a free copy of his book, You Need to Be a Little Crazy, The Truth About Starting and Growing Your Own Business.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Moltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Well, I've always thought it as fairly easy for an entrepreneur to start a business. Where they fail is when they try to scale beyond that first million. Here with the secrets of scaling is Allison Maslin, who is a serial entrepreneur who built 10 companies to seven-figure success and beyond, including cultivating a 20-year practice as a holistic physician, named as the impressive entrepreneurial force that is CEO, Allison Maslin by Entrepreneur Magazine. She's the founder of Pinnacle Global Network, offering business mentorship. She also is an experienced trapeze artist and the author of two number one best-selling books. First, Blast Off, The Surefire Success to Plan Your Dreams in Reality. And her newest book is called Scale or Fail, How to Build Your Dream Team, Explode Your Growth, and Let Your Business Soar. Allison, finally, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I feel like I've been trying to get you on the show forever. It's so great that you have here. And we're talking about a really important topic because, as I said from the outset, I think, even though a lot of folks don't think, I think it's fairly easy to get started, get a handful of customers, get going. But to really scale your business, that's hard.
It is hard. And so many people stay in that early stage of business for years and get stuck there and are, you know, never able to scale.
And so why is it so hard to scale your business? Is because people can't really think outside themselves? What things come up?
Well, we are creatures of habit, Barry, and, you know, we have a certain mindset when we start our business, and sometimes it's like survival mindset. You have to be really scrappy. And so the thought of building a team and letting go and taking leaps is very scary because you've worked so hard to get, you know, to create what you have, even in the early days, and there's this fear of losing it all. So people try to scale using the same mindset, the same marketing practices, the same management and operational practices, and it just doesn't work.
Well, this whole idea of taking leaps, I was really surprised to learn that you're a trapeze artist. Tell us a little about that and I guess how you learned to take those leaps, which is something that's really very physical.
Well, I was a gymnast growing up and my gym teacher built a set of uneven bars in my backyard made out of plastic tubing. And I just remember Barry swinging on those for hours, pretending I was Nadia Comaneci. And those were my early dreams. And then when I discovered you could actually fly on the trapeze a little later in life, I was so excited. And so after my first try, I was hooked. And then I began training in Los Angeles. I live in San Diego. So I would drive to LA every week to train with this five-generation circus family named the Gayonas, and been training with him for 20 years. And just last year, I fulfilled a dream of mine and built a whole flying trapeze rig in my backyard.
Wow. So how did you learn that first time? And I think this is really analogous to a lot of small business owners. How did you do for the first time really learn to let go?
Well, it's scary. You know, I know the first time I jumped off the trapeze, my feet would not move off the platform. They had to push me off. And so it's kind of, you know, why it's so good to work with a mentor, because they're going to hold you accountable. And, you know, the unknown feels scary for people. It's like we really want to know exactly what's going to happen. But when you come from that mindset, you miss out on all the beauty and all the miracles that are around you. Once you set that intention and you go for it and you take that leap, you really don't need to know the how, which is really works against our, you know, brain that wants to be so logical. Because once you take those leaps, you're going to be surrounding yourself with the who's, not the how's, but the who's, the people, the resources, the money. And so you have to be willing to make that decision internally that, you know, I'm ready to move forward.
So is that, Allison, when you know it's the right time to jump, is that when you have the who's on board?
No, you jump and then you find the who's. It's like you make the, I know it's like build the plane while you fly it.
Exactly.
You know, and that's really what visionaries do. Is, and they don't take no for an answer either. So meaning that when you do hit walls, which you will, you say, okay, you know, that didn't work. Let's find the solution. And so you're reaching out to people that have the answers. You're asking people, you're tweaking things, you're perfecting it along the way, not, you know, before you put it out there. And, you know, in my book, Scale or Fail, I give 5 stages that a business owner needs to go through. And I really give the steps in the book there. So you do have, you know, you have this guide, which is really nice. But in the first phase, you know, you're just starting out. You're the seeker. You've got this passion. Second phase is the pioneer, and you're getting your hands dirty. You have an assistant, maybe a marketing person or a bookkeeper. Then you move into phase 3, which I call the ringleader, which is like a circus, you know, and you're building teams and it feels a little crazy and people are not necessarily in the right roles. You've got people coming and going and you may have some employees that are feeling disengaged. And this is normal because you're still trying to figure it out, but you start to get clarity on your vision here and you start to get clarity on your market. And, you know, then but here's the thing, Barry, a lot of people get stuck right here. They get frustrated. You hear that all the time. My team isn't, you know, performing. They're not committed. They're not passionate. And that's because you have to move into phase 4, which I call the co-creator. And that's when you work with your team and you build this together. And when they come to you for answers, instead of giving the answer, you say, how would you do it? Why don't you put it together and then come back and show it to me? And they start to step up as leaders. They take ownership. They ask powerful questions like, how do we increase profit? How do we make a better customer experience? And then you move into phase 5, which is the last phase, which is the visionary. And that's where they've got it handled and you're able to step back.
I love this idea that trying to get to phase 4, because I think for a lot of small business owners, Allison, it's really tough to do because they're so used to managing by hub and spoke. For them to be the center of attention, for them to have to come up with all the great ideas, for them to be the most committed. But I always say, unless you get your team on board, and as you say, unless you get them as co-creators, your business is never going to scale.
No. And, you know, this is the part, and I see it time and time again when clients start working with me and we really dive into their company because we actually work with their team as well. And we see they're choking their employees. And they feel that way. They are afraid of making mistakes. They feel their boss is going to get mad at them. So therefore, they don't step up and offer creativity. And they don't really know exactly what they're doing. They don't understand the expectations, and they don't really get the vision of the company. And that's the most important thing. They really, you know, the vision's usually in the CEO or the founder's head, and he gets it or she gets it, but the employees are not on board. They feel like it's a job. They're clocking in and out. But once they own it and they make it their vision too, that's when everything changes.
So there's really two things here that are really at play, Allison. One is for the entrepreneur, the owner, really to get over the fear of not having to do everything themselves. The other thing is, once they're over that, how do they actually communicate that with the other people on their team?
Exactly. So that's where you create your big picture vision, which I talk about in the book, exactly how to do it. And then, you know, it's like this big document, and it's something that you and your team work on together. And it becomes part of everything you do. It's discussed in every meeting. It's shared with every vendor. It's shared with every client. And so you're putting out to the world constantly where you're taking this company, why you do what you do, you know, what your team stands for, how they're contributing. And so they get it. There is no confusion.
You know, one of the things you also talk about in the book, that the process of scaling a company is actually the ability to say no. A lot of people think that scaling, Allison, you got to keep saying yes, 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 yes. But it's really the reverse.
Yes, it seems like it's a lot harder for people to let go of things than it is to say yes and take them on. But if you're saying yes to everything, you are stressing out your team, you're overwhelming everybody, and you're diluting your success. And so if you can focus on doing 1 to 2 projects a quarter and that's it, then, you know, you're going to be hyper-focused and you're going to be able to dive deeper and see bigger results. You know, I was really guilty of this early on. And I had a woman say to me, one of my employees say, "You're like a red Ferrari, Allison, and we are running so fast just trying to keep up with you." And I thought, oh, that's not good. You know, in my mind, I didn't feel like it was that way. But, you know, you don't want your employees to feel like that they just can't keep up or they're stressed out all the time. It's not enjoyable for them.
Now, do you find that happens when, because the entrepreneur has a million things going on in their mind, a lot of ideas, and it happens because they don't stay on an idea or an implementation or a growth strategy long enough?
Yes. I mean, we're those, you know, creative types, right? So we're attracted to a lot of different things and, you know, a lot of times not super patient. So it's practice to become a leader. It's something we have to work at all of the time. And again, I have a whole assessment in my book, Scale or Fail, on how to, you know, how do you rate yourself as a leader? These are things that I have had to really work on myself. Because, you know, it's one thing to be bouncing all over the place in your personal life, but you bring that into the office, everybody's going to be confused. You're not going to make deadlines. You're going to have people frustrated and quitting their job. So it's the personal growth, the work that you do on yourself is just as important or even more important than what you're doing, you know, in that office.
Allison, I want to take a couple of questions that are coming in from the Twitter stream. First one is, should every business scale? I would say a lot of folks are comfortable where they are. They're running a $1 million business. They're taking a good amount of money home. They're happy. Should everyone scale?
No, I think that it is not for everybody. And, you know, some people don't want to have a team. They just want to have a couple of people. So, but the challenge is when you are, you know, you have a company, a lot of them, they get to $1 million, but their profit is, you know, do they even have a profit? And they're in a dollars for hours model, meaning that if they're not out seeing clients, they're not making money. If they're on vacation, they're not making money. And so it's really more of a job.
Right, exactly. Or as Carol Roth would say, you're a jobby. That's all you got. It's all about you.
Yeah, and no, there's only so many hours in the day. And at the end of the day, if you want to sell that company, it's a real challenge. And that's the asset that you're building.
So
one not for everybody, but yeah.
The next question from Twitter is, when do I know it's the right time for my business to scale?
Well, I say plan that from the beginning. You know, don't wait until you've hit a wall, because what happens is that once you run out of bandwidth and you say, okay, I don't have any hours left or manpower or woman power left, then I need to start multiplying, because that's what scaling really is. It's replicating and multiplying at a much higher rate. But if your model doesn't multiply, you pretty much need to rebuild your company at that higher level. So if you think of scaling from the beginning, you will set yourself on a course and a model that is scalable. And so it makes it a lot easier when you're ready.
Allison, I love the word you just said is, does your model multiply? Because I think most of us can understand arithmetic. And the idea is, can it really be replicated?
Definitely. And, you know, unless you have a lot of mini-me's around you, and that's really what you need to work on, and instead of feeling like most business owners feel it has to be me, I have to be the one working with the client, and our ego gets in the way, it's not true. Your customers just want to be taken care of. They want their questions answered. So it really is about becoming that leader and lifting other leaders up that are going to spread your message far and wide. And there are many methods, Barry, to scale. I go over those in the book. I have 17 different methods to scale. So it's not just building a team. There are other ways, like building a, you know, a monthly recurring income. And when you go to sell your company, that increases your valuation 3 to 5 times. Just by having a monthly recurring revenue.
Absolutely. The title of the book is called Scale or Fail, How to Build Your Dream Team, Explode Your Growth, and Let Your Business Soar. Allison, thank you so much for finally coming on the show.
I am so glad you have me. I created a gift.
We love gifts.
For your listeners.
We love
if
gifts.
If you're interested. Okay, cool. So if they go to scaleorfail.com/Barry gift, you're going to get my 17 scale strategies plus a video training exactly how to implement them. And if they want the book, they go to scaleorfail.com/Barry book.
Perfect.
And that way they get a bunch of extra gifts too.
Allison, thanks for being on the show. And I want to thank everyone for joining this week's radio show. I want to thank our sponsors, of course, Nextiva, the all-in-one communications platform, Square Payroll, the easy way to pay your team. You can go to www.square.com/go/SBR. Also want to thank LinkedIn, the place to advertise, to generate leads and build relationships to your audience. For $100 ad credit, go to www.linkedin.com/SBR. I want to thank our staff, our booking producer, Sarah Schaffer, and our in-studio producer, Lady B, our marketing manager, Courtney Gilchrist. Come on, if you are serious about being more successful this year, you got to give me a call. I've set up a private line, 773-837-8250, or you can email me at barry@moltz.com. Isn't this the year that you get your small business unstuck? Isn't this the year that you finally make the money you deserve? Remember, love everyone, trust a few, and paddle your own canoe. Have a profitable and passionate week.
You can find Barry Moltz on the web at barrymoltz.com or more episodes of Small Business Radio at smallbizradioshow.com.